story about vampires not being allowed inside without an invitation. Having pressed him on his diet, I focused on the entrance protocols. Humans are with us all the time. They just refuse to acknowledge our existence because we don't make sense in their limited world. Once they allow us in, see us for who we really are, then we're in to stay. Just as someone you've invited into your home can be hard to get rid of. They can't ignore us anymore. So it's like the stories of sunlight, I said slowly. It's not that you can't be in sunlight, but when you are, it's harder for humans to ignore you. Rather than admit that you're walking among them, humans tell themselves you can't survive the light. Matthew nodded again. They manage to ignore us anyway, of course. We can't stay indoors until it's dark. But we make more sense to humans after twilight. That goes for you, too. You should see the looks when you walk into a room or down the street. I thought about my ordinary appearance and glanced at him doubtfully. Matthew chuckled. You don't believe me, I know, but it's true. When humans see a creature in broad daylight, it makes them uneasy. We're too much for them. Too tall, too strong, too confident, too creative, too powerful, too different. They try very hard to push our square pegs into their round holes all day long. At night, it's a bit easier to dismiss us as merely odd. I stood up and removed the fish plates, happy to see that Matthew had eaten everything but the garnish. He poured a bit more of the German wine into his glass while I pulled two more plates out of the refrigerator. Each held neatly arranged slices of raw venison, so thin that the butcher insisted you could read the Oxford Mail through them. Vampires didn't like greens. We'd see about root vegetables and cheese. I heaped beets in the center of each plate and shaved Parmesan on top. A broad-bottomed decanter full of red wine went into the center of the table, where it quickly caught Matthew's attention. "May I?" he asked, no doubt worried about my burning down the college. He reached for the plain glass container, poured a bit of wine into our glasses, then held it up to his nose. "Cote roti," he said with satisfaction. "One of my favorites." I eyed the plain glass container. "You can tell that just from smelling it?" He laughed. "Some vampire stories are true. I have an exceptional sense of smell. And excellent sight and hearing, too. But even a human could tell that this was Cote roti." He closed his eyes again. "Is it 2003? My mouth gaped open. "Yes! This was better than watching a game show. There had been a little crown on the label. "Does your nose tell you who made it?" "Yes, but that's because I've walked the fields where the grapes were grown," he confessed sheepishly, as if he had been caught pulling a trick on me. "You can smell the fields in this?" I stuck my nose in the glass, relieved that the odor of horse manure was no longer there. "Sometimes I believe I can remember everything I've ever smelled. It's probably vanity," he said ruefully. "But scents bring back powerful memories. I remember the first time I smelled chocolate as if it were yesterday." "Really?" I pitched forward in my chair. "It was 1615. War hadn't broken out yet. The French king had married a Spanish princess that no one liked, especially not the king." When I smiled, he smiled back, though his eyes were fixed on some distant image. "She brought chocolate to Paris. It was as bitter as sin and as decadent, too. We drank cacao straight, mixed with water and no sugar." I laughed. "It sounds awful. Thank goodness someone figured out that chocolate deserved to be sweet. That was a human, I'm afraid. The vampires liked it bitter and thick." We picked up our forks and started in on the venison. "More Scottish food," I said, gesturing at the meat with my knife. Matthew chewed a piece. "Red deer. A young Highland stag from the taste of it." I shook my head in amazement. "As I said," he continued, "some of the stories are true." "Can you fly?" I asked, already knowing the answer. He snorted. "Of course not. We leave that to the witches, since you can control the elements, but we're strong and fast. Vampires can run and jump, which makes humans think we can fly. We're efficient, too." "Efficient?" I put my fork down, unsure whether raw venison was to my liking. "Our bodies don't waste much energy. have a lot of it to spend on moving when we need to. You don't breathe much, I said, thinking back to yoga and taking a sip of wine. No, Matthew said. Our hearts don't beat very often. We don't need to eat very often. We run cold, which slows down most bodily processes and helps explain why we live so long. The coffin story. You don't sleep much, but when you do, you sleep like the dead. He grinned. You're getting the hang of this, I see. Matthew's plate was empty of everything except for the beets, and mine was empty except for the venison. I cleared away the second course and invited him to pour more wine. The main dish was the only part of the meal that required heat, and not much of it. I had already made a bizarre biscuit-like thing from ground chestnuts. All that was left for me to do was sear some rabbit. The list of ingredients included rosemary, garlic, and celery. I decided to forego the garlic. With his sense of smell, garlic must overpower everything else. There was the nugget of truth in that vampire legend. The celery was also ruled out. Vampires categorically did not like vegetables. Spices didn't seem to pose a problem, so I kept the rosemary and ground some pepper over the rabbit while it seared in the pan. Leaving Matthew's rabbit a little underdone, I cooked mine a bit more than was required, in the hope that it would get the taste of raw venison out of my mouth. After assembling everything in an artistic pile, I delivered it to the table. This is cooked, I'm afraid, but barely. You don't think this is a test of some sort, do you? Matthew's face creased into a frown. No, no, I said hurriedly, but I'm not used to entertaining vampires. I'm relieved to hear it, he murmured. He gave the rabbit a sniff. It smells delicious. While he was bent over his plate, the heat from the rabbit amplified his distinctive scent of cinnamon and clove. Matthew forked up a bit of the chestnut biscuit. As it traveled to his mouth, his eyes widened. Chestnuts? Nothing but chestnuts, olive oil, and a bit of baking powder. And salt? And water, rosemary, and pepper, he commented calmly, taking another bite of the biscuit. Given your dietary restrictions, it's a good thing you can figure out exactly what you're putting in your mouth, I grumbled jokingly. With most of the meal behind us, I began to relax. We chatted about Oxford while I cleared the plates and brought cheese, berries, and roasted chestnuts to the table. Help yourself, I said, putting an empty plate in front of him. Matthew savored the aroma of the tiny strawberries and sighed happily as he picked up a chestnut. These really are better warm, he observed. He cracked the hard nut easily in his fingers and popped the meat out of the shell. The nutcracker hanging off the edge of the bowl was clearly optional equipment with a vampire at the table. What do I smell like? I asked, toying with the stem of my wine glass. For a few moments, it seemed as though he wasn't going to answer. The silence stretched thin before he turned wistful eyes on me. His lids fell and he inhaled deeply. You smell of willow sap and chamomile that's been crushed underfoot. He sniffed again and smiled a small, sad smile. There's honeysuckle and fallen oak leaves, too, he said softly, breathing out, along with witch hazel blooming in the first narcissus of spring. And ancient things. Whorehound, frankincense, lady's mantle. Scents I thought I'd forgotten. His eyes opened slowly, and I looked into their gray depths, afraid to breathe and break the spell his words had cast. What about me? He asked, his eyes holding on to mine. Cinnamon. My voice was hesitant. And cloves? Sometimes I think you smell of carnations. Not the kind in the florist shops, but the old-fashioned ones that grow in English cottage gardens. Clove pinks, Matthew said, his eyes crinkling at the corners in amusement. Not bad for a witch. I reached for a chestnut. Cupping the nut in my palms, I rolled it from one hand to the other, the warmth traveling up my suddenly chilly arms. Matthew sat back in his chair again, surveying my face with little flicks of his eyes. How did you decide what to serve for dinner tonight? He gestured at the berries and nuts that were left from the meal. Well, it wasn't magic. The zoology department helped a lot, I explained. He looked startled, then roared with laughter. You asked the zoology department what to make me for dinner. Not exactly, I said defensively. There were raw food recipes on the net, but I got stuck after I bought the meat. They told me what gray wolves ate. Matthew shook his head, but he was still smiling, and my irritation dissolved. Thank you, he said simply. It's been a very long time since someone made me a meal. You're welcome. The wine was the worst part. Matthew's eyes brightened. Speaking of wine, he said, standing up and folding his napkin, I brought us something to have after dinner. He asked me to fetch two fresh glasses from the kitchen. An old, slightly lopsided bottle was sitting on the table when I returned. It had a faded cream label with simple lettering and a coronet. Matthew was working the corkscrew carefully into a cork that was crumbly and black with age. His nostrils flared when he pulled it free, his face taking on the look of a cat in secure possession of a delectable canary. The wine that came out of the bottle was syrupy, its golden color glinting in the lights of the candles. Smell it, he commanded, handing me one of the glasses, and tell me what you think. I took a sniff and gasped. It smells like caramels and berries, I said, wondering how something so yellow could smell of something red. Matthew was watching me closely, interested in my reactions. Take a sip, he suggested. The wine's sweet flavors exploded in my mouth. Apricots and vanilla custard from the kitchen ladies tumbled across my tongue, and my mouth tingled with them long after I'd swallowed. It was like drinking magic. What is this? I finally said, after the taste of the wine had faded. It was made from grapes picked a long, long time ago. That summer had been hot and sunny, and the farmers worried that the rains were going to come and ruin the crop. But the weather held, they got the grapes in just before the weather changed. You can taste the sunshine, I said, earning myself another beautiful smile. During the harvest, a comet blazed over the vineyards. It had been visible through astronomers' telescopes for months, but in October it was so bright you could almost read by its light. The workers saw it as a sign that the grapes were blessed. Was this in 1986? Was it Halley's Comet? Matthew shook his head. No, it was 1811. I stared in astonishment at the almost 200-year-old wine in my glass, fearing it might evaporate before my eyes. Halley's Comet came in 1759 and 1835. He pronounced the name Halley. Where did you get it? The wine store by the train station did not have wine like this. I bought it from Antoine Marie as soon as he told me it was going to be extraordinary, he said with amusement. Turning the bottle, I looked at the label, Chateau Yquem. Even I had heard of that. And you've had it ever since, I said. He'd drunk chocolate in Paris in 1615 and received a building permit from Henry VIII in 1536. Of course he was buying wine in 1811. And there was the ancient-looking ampulla he was wearing around his neck, the cord visible at his throat. Matthew, I said slowly, watching him for any early warning signs of anger. How old are you? His mouth hardened, but he kept his voice light. I'm older than I look. I know that, I said, unable to curb my impatience. Why is my age important? I'm a historian. If somebody tells me he remembers when chocolate was introduced into France or a comet passing overhead in 1811, it's difficult not to be curious about the other events he might have lived through. You were alive in 1536. I've been to the house you had built. Did you know Machiavelli? Live through the Black Death? Attend the University of Paris when Abelard was teaching there? He remained silent. The hair on the back of my neck started to prickle. Your pilgrim's badge tells me you were once in the Holy Land. Did you go on crusade? See Halley's Comet pass over Normandy in 1066? Still nothing. Watch Charlemagne's coronation? Survive the fall of Carthage? Help keep Attila from reaching Rome? Matthew held up his right index finger. Which fall of Carthage?
You tell me.
Damn you, Hamish Osborne, he muttered, his hand flexing on the tablecloth. For the second time in 2 days, Matthew struggled over what to say. He stared into the candle, drawing his finger slowly through the flame. His flesh erupted into angry red blisters, then smoothed itself out into white, cold perfection an instant later without a flicker of pain evident on his face. I believe that my body is nearly 37 years of age. I was born around the time Clovis converted to Christianity. My parents remembered that, or I'd have no idea. We didn't keep track of birthdays back then. It's tidier to pick the date of 500 and be done with it. He looked up at me briefly and returned his attention to the candles. I was reborn a vampire in 537, and with the exception of Attila, who was before my time, you've touched on most of the high and low points in the millennium between then and the year I put the keystone into my house in Woodstock. Because you're a historian, I feel obligated to tell you that Machiavelli was not nearly as impressive as you all seem to think he was. He was just a Florentine politician, and not a terribly good one at that. A note of weariness had crept into his voice. Matthew Clairmont was more than 1,500 years old. I shouldn't pry, I said by way of apology, unsure of where to look, and mystified as to what had led me to think that knowing the historical events this vampire had lived through would help me know him better. A line from Ben Jonson floated into my mind. It seemed to explain Matthew in a way that the coronation of Charlemagne could not. He was not of an age, but for all time, I murmured. With thee conversing, I forget all time, he responded, traveling further into 17th-century literature and offering up a line from Milton. We looked at each other for as long as we could stand it, working another fragile spell between us. I broke it. What were you doing in the fall of 1859? His face darkened. What has Peter Knox been telling you? That you were unlikely to share your secrets with a witch. My voice sounded calmer than I felt. Did he? Matthew said softly, sounding less angry than he clearly was. I could see it in the set of his jaw and shoulders. In September 1859, I was looking through the manuscripts in the Ashmolean Museum. Why, Matthew? Please tell me, I urged silently, crossing my fingers in my lap. I'd provoked him into revealing the first part of his secret, but wanted him to freely give me the rest. No games, no riddles. Just tell me. I'd recently finished reading a book manuscript that was soon going to press. It was written by a Cambridge naturalist. Matthew put down his glass. My hand flew to my mouth as the significance of the date registered. Origen. Like Newton's great work of physics, the Principia, this was a book that did not require a full citation. Anyone who'd passed high school biology knew Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Darwin's article the previous summer laid out his theory of natural selection, but the book was quite different. It was marvelous, the way he established easily observable changes in nature, and inched you toward accepting something so revolutionary. But alchemy has nothing to do with evolution. Grabbing the bottle, I poured myself more of the precious wine, less concerned that it might vanish than that I might come unglued. Lamarck believed that each species descended from different ancestors and progressed independently toward higher forms of being. It's remarkably similar to what your alchemists believed, that the Philosopher's Stone was the elusive end product of a natural transmutation of base metals into more exalted metals like copper, silver, and gold. Matthew reached for the wine and I pushed it toward him. But Darwin disagreed with Lamarck, even if he did use the same word, transmutation, in his initial discussions of evolution. He disagreed with linear transmutation, it's true, but Darwin's theory of natural selection can still be seen as a series of linked transmutations. Maybe Matthew was right, and magic really was in everything. It was in Newton's theory of gravity, and it might be in Darwin's theory of evolution, too. There are alchemical manuscripts all over the world. I was trying to remain moored in the details while coming to terms with the bigger picture. Why the Ashmole manuscripts? When I read Darwin and saw how he seemed to explore the alchemical theory of transmutation through biology, I remembered stories about a mysterious book that explained the origin of our three species, demons, witches, and vampires. I'd always dismissed them as fantastic. He took a sip of wine. Most suggested that the story was concealed from human eyes in a book of alchemy. The publication of Origin prompted me to look for it, and if such a book existed, Elias Ashmole would have bought it. He had an uncanny ability to find bizarre manuscripts. You were looking for it here in Oxford 150 years ago? Yes, Matthew said. And 150 years before you received Ashmole 782, I was told that it was missing. My heart sped up, and he looked at me in concern. Keep going, I said, waving him on. I've been trying to get my hands on it ever since. Every other Ashmole manuscript was there, and none seemed promising. I've looked at manuscripts in other libraries, at the Herzog August Bibliothek in Germany, the Bibliothèque Nationale in France, the Medici Library in Florence, the Vatican, the Library of Congress. I blinked, thinking of a vampire wandering the hallways of the Vatican. The only manuscript I haven't seen is Ashmole 782. By simple process of elimination, it must be the manuscript that contains our story, if it still survives. You've looked at more alchemical manuscripts than I have. Perhaps, Matthew admitted. But it doesn't mean I understand them as well as you do. What all the manuscripts I've seen have in common, though, is an absolute confidence that the alchemist can help one substance change into another, creating new forms of life. That sounds like evolution, I said flatly. Yes, Matthew said gently. It does. We moved to the sofas, and I curled up into a ball at one end while Matthew sprawled in the corner of the other, his long legs stretched out in front of him. Happily, he'd brought the wine. Once we were settled, it was time for more honesty between us. I met a demon, Agatha Wilson, at Blackwell's last week. According to the internet, she's a famous designer. Agatha told me the demons believe that Ashmole 782 is the story of all origins, even human origins. Peter Knox told me a different story. He said it was the first grimoire, the source of all witches' power. Knox believes that the manuscript contains the secret of immortality, I said, glancing at Matthew, and how to destroy vampires. I've heard the demon and witch versions of the story. Now I want yours. Vampires believe the lost manuscript explains our longevity and our strength, he said. In the past, our fear was that this secret, if it fell into witches' hands, would lead to our extermination. Some fear that magic was involved in our making and that the witches might find a way to reverse the magic and destroy us. It seems that that part of the legend might be true. He exhaled softly, looking worried. I still don't understand why you're so certain that this book of origins, whatever it may contain, is hidden inside an alchemy book. An alchemy book could hide these secrets in plain sight, just like Peter Knox hides his identity as a witch under the veneer that he's an expert in the occult. I think it was vampires who learned that the book was alchemical. It's too perfect a fit to be coincidence. The human alchemists seemed to capture what it is to be a vampire when they wrote about the Philosopher's Stone. Becoming a vampire makes us nearly immortal, it makes most of us rich, and it gives us the chance to accrue unimaginable knowledge and learning. That's the Philosopher's Stone, all right. The parallels between this mythic substance and the creature sitting opposite me were striking and chilling. But it's still hard to imagine such a book really exists. For one thing, all the stories contradict one another. And who would be so foolish as to put so much information in one place? As with the legends about vampires and witches, there's at least a nugget of truth in all the stories about the manuscript. We just have to figure out what that nugget is and strip away the rest. Then we'll begin to understand. Matthew's face bore no trace of deceit or evasion. Encouraged by his use of we, I decided he'd earned more information. You're right about Ashmole 782. The book you've been seeking is inside it. Go on, Matthew said softly, trying to control his curiosity. It's an alchemy book on the surface. The images contain errors or deliberate mistakes. I still can't decide which. I bit my lip in concentration, and his eyes fixed on the place where my teeth had drawn a tiny bead of blood to the surface. What do you mean it's an alchemy book on the surface? Matthew held his glass closer to his nose. It's a palimpsest, but the ink hasn't been washed away. Magic is hiding the text. I almost missed the words, they're hidden so well. But when I turned one of the pages, the light was at just the right angle and I could see lines of writing moving underneath.
Could you read it?
No, I shook my head. If Ashmole 782 contains information about who we are, how we came to be, and how we might be destroyed, it's deeply buried.
It's fine if it remains buried, Matthew said grimly, at least for now. But the time is quickly coming when we will need that book.
Why? What makes it so urgent?
I'd rather show you than tell you. Can you come to my lab tomorrow?
I nodded, mystified.
We can walk there after lunch, he said, standing up and stretching.
We had emptied the bottle of wine amid all this talk of secrets and origins.
It's late. I should go.
Matthew reached for the doorknob and gave it a twist. It rattled, and the catch sprang open easily. He frowned. Have you had trouble with your lock?
No, I said, pushing the mechanism in and out. Not that I'm aware of.
You should have them look at that, he said, still jiggling the door's hardware. It might not close properly until you do. When I looked up from the door, an emotion I couldn't name flitted across his face.
I'm sorry the evening ended on such a serious note, he said softly. I did have a lovely time.
Was the dinner really all right? I asked.
We'd talked about the secrets of the universe, but I was more worried about how his stomach was faring.
It was more than all right, he assured me.
My face softened at his beautiful, ancient features. How could people walk by him on the street and not gasp? Before I could stop myself, my toes were gripping the old rug and I was stretching up to kiss him quickly on the cheek. His skin felt smooth and cold like satin, and my lips felt unusually warm against his flesh.
Why did you do that? I asked myself, coming down off my toes and gazing at the questionable doorknob to hide my confusion. It was over in a matter of seconds, but as I knew from using magic to get notes and queries off the Bodleian's shelf, a few seconds was all it took to change your life.
Matthew studied me. When I showed no sign of hysteria or an inclination to make a run for it, he leaned forward and kissed me slowly, once, twice, in the French manner. His face skimmed over mine, and he drank in my scent of willow sap and honeysuckle. When he straightened, Matthew's eyes looked smokier than usual.
"Good night, Diana," he said with a smile.
Moments later, leaning against the closed door, I spied the blinking number one on my answering machine.
Mercifully, the machine's volume was turned down. Aunt Sarah wanted to ask the same question I'd asked myself. I just didn't want to answer.
Chapter 13. Matthew came to collect me after lunch, the only creature among the human readers in the Selden End. While he walked me under the ornately painted exposed beams, he kept up a steady patter of questions about my work and what I'd been reading. Oxford had turned resolutely cold and gray, and I pulled my collar up around my neck, shivering in the damp air.
Matthew seemed not to mind and wasn't wearing a coat. The gloomy weather made him look a little less startling, but it wasn't enough to make him blend in entirely. People turned and stared in the Bodleian central courtyard, then shook their heads.
"You've been noticed," I told him. "I forgot my coat. Besides, they're looking at you, not me." He gave me a dazzling smile. A woman's jaw dropped, and she poked her friend, inclining her head in Matthew's direction. I laughed.
"You are so wrong."
We headed toward Keble College and the university parks, making a right turn at Rhodes House before entering the labyrinth of modern buildings devoted to laboratory and computer space. Built in the shadow of the Museum of Natural History,
the enormous red-brick Victorian Cathedral to Science, these were monuments of unimaginative, functional, contemporary architecture. Matthew pointed to our destination, a nondescript, low-slung building, and fished in his pocket for a plastic identity card. He swiped it through the reader at the door handle and punched in a set of codes in two different sequences. Once the door unlocked, he ushered me to the guard station, where he signed me in as a guest and handed me a pass to clip to my sweater. "That's a lot of security for a university laboratory," I commented, fiddling with the badge. The security only increased as we walked down the miles of corridors that somehow managed to fit behind the modest facade. At the end of one hallway, Matthew took a different card out of his pocket, swiped it, and put his index finger on a glass panel next to a door. The glass panel chimed, and a touchpad appeared on its surface. Matthew's fingers raced over the numbered keys. The door clicked softly open, and there was a clean, slightly antiseptic smell reminiscent of hospitals and empty professional kitchens. It derived from unbroken expanses of tile, stainless steel, and electronic equipment. A series of glass-enclosed rooms stretched ahead of us. One held a round table for meetings, a black monolith of a monitor, and several computers. Another held an old wooden desk, a leather chair, an enormous Persian rug that must have been worth a fortune, telephones, fax machines, and still more computers and monitors. Beyond were other enclosures that held banks of file cabinets, microscopes, refrigerators, autoclaves, racks upon racks of test tube centrifuges, and dozens of unrecognizable devices and instruments. The whole area seemed unoccupied, although from somewhere there came faint strains of a Bach cello concerto and something that sounded an awful lot like the latest hit recorded by the Eurovision Song Contest winners. As we passed by the two office spaces, Matthew gestured at the one with the rug. "My office," he explained. He then steered me into the first laboratory on the left. Every surface held some combination of computers, microscopes, and specimen containers arranged neatly in racks. File cabinets ringed the walls. One of their drawers had a label that read, "Less than zero." "Welcome to the history lab." The blue light made his face look whiter, his hair blacker. "This is where we're studying evolution. We take in physical specimens from old burial sites, excavations, fossilized remains, and living beings, and extract DNA from the samples." Matthew opened a different drawer and pulled out a handful of files. "We're just one laboratory among hundreds all over the world using genetics to study problems of species, origin, and extinction. The difference between our lab and the rest is that humans aren't the only species we're studying." His words dropped cold and clear around me. "You're studying vampire genetics?"
"Witches and demons, too."
Matthew hooked a wheeled stool with his foot and gently sat me on top of it. A vampire wearing black Converse high tops came rocketing around the corner and squeaked to a halt, pulling on a pair of latex gloves. He was in his late 20s, with the blonde hair and blue eyes of a California surfer. Standing next to Matthew, his average height and build made him look slight, but his body was wiry and energetic.
"AB negative," he said, studying me admiringly.
"Wow, terrific find." He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply. "And a witch, too."
"Marcus Whitmore, meet Diana Bishop. She's a professor of history from Yale."
Matthew frowned at the younger vampire. "And is here as a guest, not a pincushion."
"Oh..."
Marcus looked disappointed, then brightened. "Would you mind if I took some of your blood anyway?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact."
I had no wish to be poked and prodded by a vampire phlebotomist. Marcus whistled.
"That's some fight-or-flight response you have there, Dr. Bishop. Smell that adrenaline."
"What's going on?"
A familiar soprano voice called out. Miriam's diminutive frame was visible a few seconds later.
"Dr. Bishop is a bit overwhelmed by the laboratory, Miriam."
"Sorry, I didn't realize it was her," Miriam said. "She smells different. Is it adrenaline?"
Marcus nodded.
"Yep. Are you always like this?
All dressed up in adrenaline and no place to go?"
"Marcus."
Matthew could issue a bone-chilling warning in remarkably few syllables. "Since I was 7, I said, meeting his startling blue eyes. Marcus whistled again. "That explains a lot. No vampire could turn his back on that." Marcus wasn't referring to my physical features, even though he gestured in my direction. "What are you talking about?" I asked, curiosity overcoming my nerves. Matthew pulled on the hair at his temples and gave Marcus a glare that would curdle milk. The younger vampire looked blasé and cracked his knuckles. I jumped at the sharp sound.
"Vampires are predators, Diana," Matthew explained. "We're attracted to the fight-or-flight response. When people or animals become agitated, we can smell it."
"We can taste it, too. Adrenaline makes blood even more delicious," Marcus said. "Spicy, silky, and then it turns sweet. Really good stuff."
A low rumble started in Matthew's throat. His lips curled away from his teeth, and Marcus stepped backward. Miriam placed her hand firmly on the blonde vampire's forearm.
"What? I'm not hungry," Marcus protested, shaking off Miriam's hand.
"Dr. Bishop may not know that vampires don't have to be physically hungry to be sensitive to adrenaline, Marcus."
Matthew controlled himself with visible effort.
"Vampires don't always need to feed, but we always crave the hunt and the adrenaline reaction of prey to predator."
Given my struggle to control anxiety, it was no wonder Matthew was always asking me out for a meal. It wasn't my honeysuckle scent that made him hungry. It was my excess adrenaline.
"Thank you for explaining, Matthew."
Even after last night, I was still relatively ignorant about vampires. "I'll try to calm down."
"There's no need," Matthew said shortly. "It's not your job to calm down. It's our job to exercise a modicum of courtesy and control."
He glowered at Marcus and pulled one of the files forward.
Miriam shot a worried glance in my direction.
"Maybe we should start at the beginning."
"No, I think it's better to start at the end," he replied, opening the file.
"Do they know about Ashmole 782? I asked Matthew, when Miriam and Marcus showed no sign of leaving. He nodded.
"And you told them what I saw?"
He nodded again.
"Did you tell anyone else?"
Miriam's question to me reflected centuries of suspicion.
"If you mean Peter Knox, no.
Only my aunt and her partner Emily know."
"Three witches and three vampires sharing a secret," Marcus said thoughtfully, glancing at Matthew. "Interesting."
"Let's hope we can do a better job keeping it than we've done at hiding this."
Matthew slid the file toward me.
Three sets of vampire eyes watched me attentively as I opened it. "Vampire on the loose in London," the headline screamed. My stomach flopped over, and I moved the newspaper clipping aside. Underneath was the report of another mysterious death involving a bloodless corpse. Below that was a magazine story, accompanied by a picture that made its contents clear, despite my inability to read Russian. The victim's throat had been ripped open from jaw to carotid artery. There were dozens more murders, and reports in every language imaginable. Some of the deaths involved beheadings. Some involved corpses drained of blood, without a speck of blood evidence found at the scene. Others suggested an animal attack, due to the ferocity of the injuries to the neck and torso.
"We're dying," Matthew said, when I pushed the last of the stories aside.
"Humans are dying, that's for sure."
My voice was harsh.
"Not just the humans," he said. "Based on this evidence, vampires are exhibiting signs of species deterioration."
"This is what you wanted to show me?"
My voice shook.
"What do these have to do with the origin of creatures or Ashmole 782?
Jillian's recent warnings had stirred painful memories, and these pictures only brought them into sharper focus.
"Hear me out," Matthew said quietly, "please."
He might not be making sense, but he wasn't deliberately frightening me either. Matthew must have had a good reason for sharing this. Hugging the file folder, I sat down on my stool.
"These deaths," he began, drawing the folder gently away from me, "result from botched attempts to transform humans into vampires.
What was once second nature to us has become difficult. Our blood is increasingly incapable of making new life out of death.
Failure to reproduce would make any species extinct. Based on the pictures I'd just seen, however, the world didn't need more vampires.
It's easier for those who are older, vampires such as myself, who fed predominantly on human blood when we were young, Matthew continued. As a vampire ages, however, we feel less compulsion to make new vampires. Younger vampires, though, are a different story. They want to start families to dispel the loneliness of their new lives. When they find a human they want to mate with, or try to make children, some discover that their blood isn't powerful enough.
You said we're all going extinct, I reminded him evenly, my anger still simmering.
Modern witches aren't as powerful as their ancestors were. Miriam's voice was matter of fact, and you don't produce as many children as in times past.
That doesn't sound like evidence. It sounds like a subjective assessment, I said.
You want to see the evidence?
Miriam picked up two more file folders and tossed them across the gleaming surface so that they slid into my arms.
There it is, though I doubt you'll understand much of it.
One had a purple-edged label with Benvenguda typed neatly on it. The other had a red-edged label, bearing the name Good Beatrice. The folders contained nothing but graphs. Those on top were hooped-shaped and brilliantly colored. Underneath, more graphs showed black and gray bars marching across white paper.
That's not fair, Marcus protested. No historian could read those.
These are DNA sequences, I said, pointing to the black and white images. But what are the colored graphs? Matthew rested his elbows on the table next to me. They're also genetic test results, he said, drawing the hoop-covered page closer. These tell us about the mitochondrial DNA of a woman named Benvenguda, which she inherited from her mother and her mother's mother and every female ancestor before her. They tell us the story of her matrilineage.
What about her father's genetic legacy?
Matthew picked up the black and white DNA results. Benvenguda's human father is here, in her nuclear DNA, her genome, along with her mother who was a witch. He returned to the multicolored hoops. But the mitochondrial DNA, outside the cell's nucleus, records only her maternal ancestry.
Why are you studying both her genome and her mitochondrial DNA?
I had heard of the genome, but mitochondrial DNA was new territory for me. Your nuclear DNA tells us about you as a unique individual, how the genetic legacy of your mother and father recombined to create you. It's the mixture of your father's genes and your mother's genes that gave you blue eyes, blonde hair, and freckles. Mitochondrial DNA can help us to understand the histories of a whole species.
That means the origin and evolution of the species is recorded in every one of us, I said slowly. It's in our blood and every cell in our body.
Matthew nodded. But every origin story tells another tale, not of beginnings, but of endings.
We're back to Darwin, I said, frowning. Origin wasn't entirely about where different species came from. It was about natural selection and species extinction, too.
Some would say origin was mostly about extinction, Marcus agreed, rolling up to the other side of the lab bench.
I looked at Benvenguda's brilliant hoops.
Who was she?
A very powerful witch, Miriam said, who lived in Brittany in the 7th century. She was a marvel in an age that produced many marvels. Beatrice Good is one of her last known direct descendants.
Did Beatrice Good's family come from Salem? I whispered, touching her folder. There had been Goods living there alongside the bishops and proctors.
Beatrice's lineage includes Sarah and Dorothy Good of Salem, Matthew said, confirming my hunch.
He opened Beatrice's file folder and put her mitochondrial test results next to those of Benvenguda.
But they're different, I said. You could see it in the colors and the way they were arranged.
Not so different, Matthew corrected me.
Beatrice's nuclear DNA has fewer markers common among witches. This indicates that her ancestors, as the centuries passed, relied less and less on magic and witchcraft as they struggled to survive.
Those changing needs began to force mutations in her DNA, mutations that pushed the magic aside.
His message sounded perfectly scientific, but it was meant for me. Beatrice's ancestors pushed their magic aside, and that will eventually destroy the family?
It's not entirely the witch's fault. Nature is to blame, too.
Matthew's eyes were sad. It seems that witches, like vampires, have also felt the pressures of surviving in a world that is increasingly human. Demons, too. They exhibit less genius, which was how we used to distinguish them from the human population, and more madness.
The humans aren't dying out? I asked.
Yes and no, Matthew said.
We think that the humans have, until now, proved better at adapting. Their immune systems are more responsive, and they have a stronger urge to reproduce than either vampires or witches. Once the world was divided more evenly between humans and creatures. Now humans are in the majority, and creatures make up only 10% of the world's population.
The world was a different place when there were as many creatures as humans.
Miriam sounded regretful that the genetic deck was no longer stacked in our favor.
But their sensitive immune systems are going to get humans in the end.
How different are we, the creatures, from humans?
Considerably, at least on the genetic level. We appear similar, but under the surface, our chromosomal makeup is distinctive.
Matthew sketched a diagram on the outside of Beatrice Good's folder.
Humans have 23 chromosomal pairs in every cell nucleus, each arranged in long code sequences. Vampires and witches have 24 chromosome pairs.
More than humans, Pinot Noir grapes, or pigs, Marcus winked. What about demons?
They have the same number of chromosome pairs as humans, but they also have a single extra chromosome. As far as we can tell, it's their extra chromosome that makes them demonic, Matthew replied, and prone to instability.
While I was studying his pencil sketch, a piece of hair fell into my eyes. I pushed at it impatiently.
What's in the extra chromosomes?
It was as hard for me to keep up with Matthew now as it had been managing to pass college biology.
Genetic material that distinguishes us from humans, Matthew said, as well as material that regulates cell function, or is what scientists call junk DNA.
It's not junk, though, Marcus said. All that genetic material has to be left over from previous selection, or it's waiting to be used in the next evolutionary change. We just don't know what its purpose is. Yet.
Wait a minute, I interjected. Witches and demons are born. I was born with an extra pair of chromosomes, and your friend Hamish was born with a single extra chromosome. But vampires aren't born, you're made, from human DNA. Where do you acquire an extra chromosome pair?
When a human is reborn a vampire, the Maker first removes all the human's blood, which causes organ failure. Before death can occur, the Maker gives his or her blood to the one being reborn, replied Matthew. As far as we can tell, the influx of a vampire's blood forces spontaneous genetic mutations in every cell of the body.
Matthew had used the term reborn last night, but I'd never heard the word maker in connection with vampires before.
The maker's blood floods the reborn system, carrying new genetic information with it, Miriam said. Something similar happens with human blood transfusions. But a vampire's blood causes hundreds of modifications in the DNA.
We started looking in the genome for evidence of such explosive change, Matthew explained. We found it. Mutations proving that all new vampires went through a spontaneous adaptation to survive when they absorbed their maker's blood. That's what prompts the development of an extra chromosome pair.
A genetic Big Bang. You're like a galaxy born from a dying star. In a few moments, your genes transform you into something else. Something inhuman.
I looked at Matthew in wonder. Are you all right? He asked. We can take a break.
Could I have some water?
I'll get it.
Marcus hopped up from his stool.
There's some in the specimen fridge.
Humans provided the first clue that acute cellular stress from bacteria and other forms of genetic bombardment could trigger quick mutations, rather than the slower changes of natural selection.
Miriam pulled a folder out of a file drawer. Opening it, she pointed to a section of a black-and-white graph. This man died in 1375. He survived smallpox, but the disease forced a mutation on the third chromosome as his body quickly coped with the influx of bacteria.
Marcus returned with my water. I took the cap off and drank thirstily.
Vampire DNA is full of similar mutations resulting from disease resistance. Those changes might be slowly leading to our extinction.
Matthew looked worried.
Now we're trying to focus on what it is about vampire blood that triggers the generation of new chromosomes. The answer may lie in the mitochondria.
Miriam shook her head.
No way. The answer's in the nuclear DNA. When a body is assaulted by vampire blood, it must trigger a reaction that makes it possible for the body to capture and assimilate the changes.
Maybe, but if so, we need to look more closely at the junk DNA too. Everything must be there to generate new chromosomes, Marcus insisted.
While the three of them argued, I was rolling up my sleeve. When the fabric cleared my elbow and the veins in my arm were exposed to the cool air of the laboratory, they directed their freezing attention at my skin.
Diana, Matthew said coldly, touching his Lazarus badge, what are you doing?
Do you still have your gloves handy, Marcus? I asked, continuing to inch my sleeve up.
Marcus grinned.
Yeah?
He stood and pulled a pair of latex gloves out of a nearby box.
You don't have to do this.
Matthew's voice caught in his throat.
I know that. I want to.
My veins looked even bluer in the lab's light.
Good veins, Miriam said with a nod of approval,
eliciting a warning purr from the tall vampire standing next to me. If this is going to be a problem for you, Matthew, wait outside, I said calmly.
Before you do this, I want you to think about it, Matthew said,
bending over me protectively, as he had when Peter Knox had approached me at the Bodleian.
We have no way of predicting what the tests will reveal. It's your whole life and your family's history, all laid out in black and white. Are you absolutely sure you want that scrutinized?
What do you mean, my whole life? The intensity of his stare made me squirm.
These tests tell us about a lot more than the color of your eyes and your hair. They'll indicate what other traits your mother and father passed down to you, not to mention traits from all your female ancestors.
We exchanged a long look. That's why I want you to take a sample from me, I said patiently. Confusion passed over his face. I've wondered my whole life what the bishop blood was doing as it pumped through my veins. Everyone who knew about my family wondered. Now we'll know.
It seemed very simple to me. My blood could tell Matthew things I didn't want to risk discovering haphazardly.
I didn't want to set fire to the furniture or fly through the trees or think a bad thought about someone only to have that person fall deathly ill 2 days later. Matthew might think giving blood was risky. To me it seemed safe as houses, all things considered.
Besides, you told me witches are dying out. I'm the last bishop. Maybe my blood will help you figure out why. We stared at each other, vampire and witch, while Miriam and Marcus waited patiently.
Finally, Matthew made a sound of exasperation.
Bring me the specimen kit, he told Marcus.
I can do it, Marcus said defensively, snapping the wrist on his latex gloves. Miriam tried to hold him back, but Marcus kept coming at me with a box of vials and sharps.
Marcus, Miriam warned.
Matthew grabbed the equipment from Marcus and stopped the younger vampire with a startling, deadly look.
I'm sorry, Marcus, but if anyone is going to take Diana's blood, it's going to be me.
Holding my wrist in his cold fingers, he bent my arm up and down a few times before extending it fully and resting my hand gently on the stainless surface. There was something undeniably creepy about having a vampire stick a needle into your vein. Matthew tied a piece of rubber tubing above my elbow.
Make a fist, he said quietly,
pulling on his gloves and preparing the hollow needle and the first vial. I did as he asked, clenching my hand and watching the veins bulge. Matthew didn't bother with the usual announcement that I would feel a prick or a sting. He just leaned down without ceremony and slid the sharp metal instrument into my arm.
Nicely done.
I loosened my fist to get the blood flowing freely. Matthew's wide mouth tightened while he changed vials. When he was finished, he withdrew the needle and tossed it into a sealed biohazard container. Marcus collected the vials and handed them to Miriam, who labeled them in a tiny, precise script. Matthew put a square of gauze over the stick site and held it there with strong, cold fingers. With his other hand, he picked up a roll of adhesive tape and attached it securely across the pad.
"Date of birth?"
Miriam asked crisply, pen poised over the test tube.
"August 13th, 1976."
Miriam stared.
"August 13th?"
"Yes.
Why?"
"Just being sure," she murmured.
"In most cases, we like to take a cheek swab, too."
Matthew opened a package and removed two white pieces of plastic. They were shaped like miniature paddles, the wide end slightly rough. Wordlessly, I opened my mouth and let Matthew twirl first one swab, then the other against the inside of my cheek. Each swab went into a different sealed plastic tube.
All done.
Looking around the lab, at the quiet serenity of stainless steel and blue lights, I was reminded of my alchemists, toiling away over charcoal fires in dim light with improvised equipment and broken clay crucibles. What they would have given for the chance to work in a place like this, with tools that might have helped them understand the mysteries of creation.
"Are you looking for the first vampire?" I asked, gesturing at the file drawers.
"Sometimes," Matthew said slowly. "Mostly we're tracking how food and disease affect the species, and how and when certain family lines go extinct."
"And is it really true we're four distinct species? Or do demons, humans, vampires, and witches share a common ancestor?"
I'd always wondered if Sarah's insistence that witches shared little of consequence with humans or other creatures was based on anything more than tradition and wishful thinking. In Darwin's time, many thought that it was impossible for a pair of common human ancestors to have produced so many different racial types. When some white Europeans looked at black Africans, they embraced the theory of polygenism instead, which argued that the races had descended from different, unrelated ancestors.
"Demons, humans, vampires, and witches vary considerably at the genetic level."
Matthew's eyes were piercing. He understood why I was asking, even though he refused to give me a straight answer. "If you prove we aren't different species but only different lineages within the same species, it will change everything," I warned.
"In time, we'll be able to figure out how, if, the four groups are related. We're still a long way from that point, though."
He stood. "I think that's enough science for today." After saying goodbye to Miriam and Marcus, Matthew drove me to New College. He went to change and returned to pick me up for yoga. We rode to Woodstock in near silence, both lost in our own thoughts. At the old lodge, Matthew let me out as usual, unloaded the mats from the trunk, and slung them over his shoulder. A pair of vampires brushed by. One touched me briefly, and Matthew's hand was lightning fast as he laced his fingers through mine. The contrast between us was so striking, his skin so pale and cold, and mine so alive and warm in comparison. Matthew held on to me until we got inside. After class, we drove back to Oxford, talking first about something Amira had said, then about something one of the demons had inadvertently done or not done that seemed to perfectly capture what it was to be a demon. Once inside the New College gates, Matthew uncharacteristically turned off the car before he let me out. Fred looked up from his security monitors when the vampire went to the lodge's glass partition. The porter slid it open.
"Yes?"
"I'd like to walk Dr. Bishop to her rooms. Is it all right if I leave the car here, and the keys, too, in case you need to shift it?"
Fred eyed the John Radcliffe tag and nodded. Matthew tossed the keys through the window.
"Matthew," I said urgently, "it's just across the way. You don't have to walk me home."
"I am, though,"
he said, in a tone that inhibited further discussion. Beyond the lodge's archways and out of Fred's sight, he caught my hand again. This time, the shock of his cold skin